Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my very own safety car. It's obviously Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux as the UK's largest specialist insurance broker. Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, how are you, mate? You look a bit peaky, if I might say.
Well, I might have a little bit of a bug, Jason Plato. I think, have you heard of this bug that's going around at the moment?
Nope.
It's called... Not heard of thing. COVID? Yeah, I think I might have just tested positive for that. So if I sound a little bit more nasal than I normally do, that'll be why.
Are you sure this isn't just a ruse because you were out last night?
No, I promise you. I tested positive for COVID on Saturday morning. At the time of recording, it is Monday morning, Monday the 13th of December. And I've been holed up in bed. It's a good job, actually, that we now record these podcasts remotely, because if we didn't, then obviously you'd be flying solo this morning with our special guest for the week. And I tell you what, we couldn't have timed this any better.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
This is inspired booking.
Well, I mean, it is incredible. Our special guest today is a gentleman who's had a distinguished racing career in Formula One and Formula E and a whole host of other stuff. And he now presents... He's my co-presenter on Fifth Gear Recharge, and he also covers F1 for Sky, which is why, as you say, he's an inspired booking this week. It is, of course, the one and only, my mate, Karun Chandhok. Hello, mate. How are you?
Hello. I'm quite tired, if I'm perfectly honest. It's been a mentally exhausting weekend out in Abu Dhabi, and I landed back at Heathrow 2 hours ago, and here I am.
I can't believe you're back. I can't believe you're back already.
Well, I had to come back for your podcast, JP. You know, the good abuse lad. I would have got if I missed it.
He's good, isn't he?
I mean, that's proper jet fresh, Karun. I mean, we've never had a guest quite as jet fresh as that.
Yeah, that's because Plato's normally had the G&Ts the night before. So, you know.
Well, order. That's right.
No, listen, it's great to be here. There's just so many thoughts flying around the internet, flying around all of our heads. I'm sure we've all... watched and rewatched and tried to relive what happened last night.
Come on, give us your take. Give us your take. Don't sit on the fence.
My take on the finish. Yeah. Well, I think, to be honest, it was messy.
Or massy.
Yeah, good one. COVID hasn't entered your humour. I think, personally, they should have done two other things, really. Either they should have red flagged the race and had a four-lap sprint to the finish on fresh set of tyres. And then it's a straight fight, right? You know, yeah. Best driver wins. They're both standing start, Lewis on pole because he was leading the race, and a straight fight. Or B, they should have let the lapped cars stay between Lewis and Max. And then I think it still would have been very exciting because Max would have cleared those five cars probably in the first half of the lap. And then we would have had an unbelievable final half lap of the race because he would have had, you know, the fresh soft tires, 2-3 seconds a lap quicker than the tires Lewis had, and they would have gone for it till the last corner. So I think we would have still had a very exciting finish in both of those scenarios, but it would have felt a little bit more fair to Lewis, who did a brilliant job dominating that race until that last safety car.
So what time did you leave the paddock last night then?
10:30.
That's local time.
Yeah, sorry, 10:30 local time when they were just coming out of the stewards room. Just intense. It was weird because, you know, Red Bull were celebrating and trying to be happy and celebrate. But then we kept getting news that, you know, they're going back to the stewards, and Christian and Adrian had to go back into the stewards with Jonathan Wheatley, the team manager. And then you saw, you know, Mercedes are obviously absolutely crestfallen because... Mm. Until Latifi's crash, they had the championship. You know, it was there. The champagne was on ice, ready to go. And to be fair to Mercedes and Lewis, they started the season on the back foot. They started the year probably 3/10 behind Red Bull. And they've done an unbelievable job. If you look at the last four Grand Prix, they had the fastest car on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that's an amazing turnaround. And Lewis showed his quality as well. So I thought out of... everything that unfolded at the end of the race, you know, obviously Toto was furious and the engineers and Mercedes absolutely distraught. I thought Lewis was incredible in the way he handled it.
Yeah, me too. Special human being, that guy, you know.
I mean, just an example, right, to any young racing driver, young sportsman, frankly, in how to be magnanimous in defeat. It is the way he he handle it. You know, we saw Anthony Hamilton, his dad, going to congratulate Jos and Max straight, yeah, even before the podium, in fact. And I thought that was...
Yeah, sheer class, that. Class.
Yeah, real class. Real class.
So what happens now then, do you think? As you say, we have to keep stating the fact that this is Monday the 13th, and obviously the podcast will then air on the 15th. So there is the chance that stuff might date here. But what is your feeling, Karun, in terms of what may happen in the next 48 hours, for example?
Look, so Mercedes have a point, which is they believe, the regulations say that any lap cars have to be released to go past the safety car, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not selective. So what's happened here is obviously five cars were selected to go past and not the other three, which was Ricciardo, Stroll and Schumacher. Mm-hmm. So that's their first point is, listen, you can't pick and choose who gets let past. And it is unprecedented. I mean, certainly I can't remember it happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other point they've got is somewhere in the rules, and I can't remember the article off the top of my head, but I believe it says that when the lap cars get let past, racing will resume on the following lap.
Yeah.
And again, that didn't happen. Racing resumed on, you know, at the end of that current lap. Mm-hmm. Now, the FIA have said, listen, the primary objective was to get racing up and running. We wanted to finish the race and the world championship under green flag racing conditions. That was their motivation, which I understand. You know, yeah, none of us want to see the world championship finish under a yellow flag. It's a bit of a damn squib.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I can't see the result being overturned. I just can't. You know, the stewards dismissed it, saying, you know, if they went with what Mercedes wanted, which was a count back to a couple of laps, that effectively shortens the race distance, right? And then,
yeah,
you know, that affects people like Tsunoda, who finished fourth. And there's a whole load of complications like that. You can't just shorten the race. And
I mean, there is no solution, is there?
And that's why I don't think anything will happen. I think Max will remain world champion. But look, at the end of the day, both of them deserve to be world champion. They've done an outstanding job. You know, I talked about Lewis before coming from behind the start of the year. But look at Max, right? 18 podiums. It's a record in Formula One. He's beaten Schumacher's record, beaten Lewis's record.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
18 podiums out of 22 races. And in every one of those, he's finished first or second.
Wow.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
It's astonishing. The guy's, you know, he started the year off being 23 years old. He's now 24. Mm. And the races he didn't finish were obviously Silverstone, Monza, where they collided. Bottas wiped him out in Budapest.
Yeah.
And the tire blew in Baku when he was comfortably looking on course to win. So it's funny because I'm about to write a column about picking my top 10 for the season, which is a really tough thing to do, to be honest, every year. And this year is harder than any because you can make a strong case for Lewis or Max, but ultimately, I do think Max, given the fact that he handled the pressure of going for his first world championship so well, the only mistake he made really was that qualifying lap in Saudi Arabia at the last corner when he hit the wall.
Silverstone, I think that was a mistake. I think if he was a few years older, He wouldn't have done what he did at Silverstone. He would have given it. He would have yielded. Give Lewis a bit of space, and he would have come second. And actually, then he would have turned up at Abu Dhabi, miles in the lead, cruise home for a championship. Do you think?
But I don't classify that as a mistake. I just classify that ultimately, I think Lewis was the one who went in there hot and deep, missed the apex, and understeer wide. I don't disagree with you. I do think if I was in Max's situation, I would have given another car's width. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think you can say that was a mistake. That, you know, Max races in the way Michael used to race. He's very uncompromising, and he wasn't going to compromise.
Absolutely. But I think a few more years on him, he'll look at that and think, actually, hold on. And he'd just round himself off, and he could become the greatest ever.
Well, this is what I was going to suggest, actually. Because of his age, you know, he was only 17 when he started, was he not? And so he's now, what, 23, 24? In terms of actually being that good, that young, I mean, he's got the potential to go on to be the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
But he's won his first championship a year before Michael won his, hasn't he? And Michael went on to win seven. So, it is entirely possible. I think the other thing you've got to think about is this season for me, you know, now that we've mentioned Michael, for me, this is the season we should have had in 1994 you had Schumacher versus Senna and we were all tragically denied that. You know, you had this young, hungry, aggressive, uncompromising pretender to the king's crown. And We never saw that play out, whereas this year we did. And
I think you're bang on there. I think that you've hit the nail right on the head.
And you know, the intensity. I mean, I was obviously, you know, in the paddock and you're talking to the team owners and, you know, the drivers and the engineers. The intensity of this year goes back to Michael and Damon, really. You know, you look at Schumacher and Hakkinen, it was pretty cordial. You know, they had a couple of moments, but it was pretty cordial. Yeah. Fernando and Michael was again very friendly. You know, there was an edge between Lewis and Fernando, of course, when they were teammates, but ultimately Kimi won the championship. Yeah. And Kimi was fine with either, you know, and the following year, Lewis and Felipe got on fine. You know, we never had this level of almost animosity between the two camps. Unless you go back to the Bennett and Williams days, and then before that, obviously Prost Senna, and then you go Mansell, Piquet, et cetera, right?
So that's great for the sport, though, surely.
Oh man, I mean, our viewing figures this year have been off the chart.
I bet, because you need to have. I think, you know, almost in any sport, you need to have that rivalry. Sport is all about rivalry, and to have the two pretenders to the crown, if you like, you know, whoever that might be. And as you say, there's various different pairings that we've discussed over history, and actually now to have this pairing in 2021 is as good as anything we've seen.
Yeah. I was led to believe by someone at F1 that yesterday's race would be the highest watch Formula One race in history worldwide. Not the UK necessarily, but if you look at it worldwide,
yeah,
that would have been the highest watch race in F1 history.
Well, do you know what? I've just had a conversation with Kevin Turner today, who's the chief editor of Autosport, and he said this weekend he's had calls from like uni mates who are not interested in motorsport. His wife watched it and she can't stand motorsport. So I think actually it's drawn in a whole new audience, which are fresh to it because it was so exciting, I think.
Yeah, and listen, that has a trickle-down effect, Jason, doesn't it, to everyone in the sport. It doesn't matter whether it's touring cars or Formula 3. You know, it doesn't matter what category it is. I think if people are interested in F1, they suddenly become interested in motor racing, and it starts with F1, you know. It's, you saw it in the 90s, right? You know, when you had the era of Big Nige and Damon, the UK went mad for it. And therefore, you guys in the touring car world benefited, I think. You know, yeah, you had big crowds and manufacturers, etc. Because there's a hunger for motor racing. And
absolutely.
I think we're seeing that. You know, we're seeing, you look in the US, when we went to Austin, the guys from ESPN were saying they were up nearly 30% their viewership.
Is that right?
Mm. And, you know, we at Sky this year, our viewership was double what it was in 2018.
Good Lord.
Says a lot.
Double?
Double what it was in 2018.
That is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey, Dave, you know, we mentioned Big Nige then.
Yes.
Do you know what car he's driven? Caroon, a few times, actually. Only Red 5.
Oh, really?
He's driven it.
It's a screensaver on my phone.
I mean, can you imagine what that must be like? Tell us. Come on, Karoo. Tell us. Probably one of the greatest race cars ever, isn't it?
You've got to say it's in the top five, haven't you? It's got to be right up there in the top five. I mean, you know, you just listen to the list of people who are there building that car. Patrick Head, Adrian Newey, Paddy Lowe, Jeff Willis, you know, incredible. And then when we think of the British Grand Prix,
yeah,
you know, most people, their first thought, if you're of a certain generation, is Big Nige driving down Hangar Straight, crowd going mental, crowd invasion, blah, blah, blah. And that was it. And, you know, for me, that was the image I grew up watching as a kid. So I got to drive, as you said, the car on several occasions. The most special was at the British Grand Prix weekend in 2017. You know, Silverstone gave us track time. So I drove it on Saturday evening after qualifying and then Sunday morning with the whole crowd there before the Grand Prix. I did some demo laps. And it, you know, you're going on Hangar Straight and it's like I could hear Murray Walker's voice in my head as you're going down the Stowe corner. That, you know, that view as you're looking, you know, through the front of that car. It was exactly as I remember it as a kid watching it on TV. So, but, it, you know, car design, obviously in 92, active suspension, a blown diffuser, traction control, launch control. You know, it had all the tricks and they designed it on MS-DOS. it's just, emotionally, the best driving experience I've ever had in my life. And I know I've been very lucky. I've driven 26 different Formula One cars.
So, Karun, take us back to the beginning then. Where did it all start for you? I know that Your father was into motor racing. Your grandfather, I believe, was also into motor racing. So was it a given that you were going to follow in their footsteps and have a career in cars?
I don't think it was a given. You know, they both raced and rallied a lot. My grandmother did some racing as well in the 70s.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. But it wasn't a given, and nor did they push me into it. You know, for example, mm-hmm. my brother has no interest in motor racing. He played cricket and, you know, he's got no real interest in motor racing apart from obviously watches it now. And he came to some of my races and things like that. But I just loved it. You know, as a kid growing up, I grew up around cars. We you know, my dad sort of stopped racing and driving himself, you know, towards the late 90s. And we ran a rally team. And I traveled around going to the service parks and, you know, helping the mechanics build the cars. And I learned how to use spanners. And
what sort of age are you here, Karan?
I was a teenager. I was 13, 14, traveling mm-hmm. around India, going to races and rallies. So that's where the interest started.
And where was this in Madras?
Yep.
What's called Chennai now, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And every year we used to have what was called the Madras Grand Prix, where we had a Formula 3 race. It was a one-off cameo. And again, you know, my dad used to drive in it early on. And then when he stopped, we used to get people like, you know, we had Steve Robertson and Warren Hughes and people like that come down from here. And it was really funny because I ever since I was a kid, I was into it. And I read Autosport. We never got F1 on TV. The first F1 race that got broadcast was the Spanish Grand Prix in 1993. So I would have to rely on VHS tapes coming from friends of ours in England.
Wow.
You know, I would watch the British Grand Prix at Christmas time or something like that. And that was the only way I could soak it up. But
that sounds just unbelievable that it wasn't there until 93. That's incredible.
Yeah, well, we didn't have satellite TV until 91 or 92. So, and then, you know, we would get Autosport, but because the post would come so late, we get it 8 weeks late. It was bizarre. But, you know, I just soaked it all up. So when my dad had to make these decisions on which drivers to sign to race in the Madras Grand Prix, you know, I would be helping him make these decisions and I'd be selecting the drivers for him.
Wow.
And looking back, it's ridiculous because we're talking 90, Warren came in 94, Steve came in 93. You know, I was 9 or 10 years old. And I'm choosing the drivers for our race team.
How cool is that?
Bonkers.
And did you choose anyone which you then subsequently went to race against, you know, in years after?
No, but Warren came back to do some driver coaching for me. You know, he's an excellent driver coach who never had the opportunity to race in F1, but I think he certainly had more speed and talent than his career deserved. I mean, you raced against him in touring cars, you know, very, very good driver and just a nice bloke.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, supremely talented. You know, him and actually Kelvin Burt as well. I mean, they were two contemporaries of mine, which actually good enough for F1, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's where it started. And then, you know, but we had no go-karting. That's the problem. That was the problem back then. I've never done a go-kart race in my life. So the first race I did, we had a little single-seater with an 800cc engine, standard four-speed gearbox, sort of like your Formula First that I mm-hmm. guess you had in the UK. And that was my first steps into racing. I raced in that, and I raced in a saloon car championship with a Suzuki Swift when I was 16. And that was it. So, you know, went to race in Asia for a year and then came to the UK when I turned 18 and never left.
To have been involved in motorsport through your family and obviously, as you say, as a young age, being heavily involved, picking the drivers with your dad, etc. Then to get into racing makes total sense. But to make that step from early racing in a Suzuki Swift or whatever you're saying to actually Formula One is a phenomenal leap.
Yeah.
Were you single-minded at that point that was where you were going to get to? Did you have your eyes on Formula One from a very early age?
100%. And I think you have to. And, you know, call it naive, call it optimism, you know, youthful optimism, I guess. Mm. But you have to believe in this dream. And I got very lucky, as you know, as Jason well and truly knows, you need to have the certain key moments where a certain sponsor has to come in at the right time, a certain deal has to happen at the right time, and doors will open. You know, there were several points along the way where I ran out of money and couldn't carry on. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think there was a key point in 2006. I'd won the Asian Championship, but had no money. And basically, I was going to take a job as a team manager for a mate's Formula 3 team. I knew I wanted to carry on working in the business, and I was going to take a job as a team manager. And it just happened that Red Bull were, you know, looking to have some other drivers in F2, and they wanted an Asian driver on their driver lineup. And next thing I know, they put in half the budget for me to do GP2.
Wow.
As it was called at the time. And, you know, I had a bit of time to scramble another half budget, and away we went. And that was it. That kept me going, you know. It was tough. And certainly coming from a country like India where the money isn't flowing into the sport, and, you know, the things like the currency exchange rate really hit us quite badly and continue to hit us quite badly. It's, you know, it's not a coincidence that we've got 1.2 billion people and two Formula One drivers. you know, it really is kind of against the odds. And, you know, for me, even making it to F1 for me is a big thing, you know, especially coming from India.
It's massive.
It's huge, mate. It's huge. You know, if you look at the landscape in the UK to the level of motorsport from right the way down the bottom and how it's put together and how, you know, it's televised, it's professional. And then you think about where you've come from, mate, that's a remarkable achievement.
And you know, going to places like Le Mans, right, which frankly, nobody in India had even really heard of. Probably, I could count, you know, maybe 100 people had heard of Le Mans before I went there. And to be the first from your country to do something is, you know, I remember going to Le Mans, and I'm not Jason, you know, I'm not a particularly emotional person, but...
Oh, I've seen you cry a few times.
You haven't really. It's only when you're driving me around.
Look, I was coming to that.
Yeah. But, you know, but standing on the grid, and Le Mans, it's pretty cool because they play the national anthem of every driver on the grid. And for whatever reason, in 2012, they played the Indian national anthem first that day. And I had a, you know, proper goosebumps. We had, was the first time in Indian racing at Le Mans. There were 30-odd journalists had come over, and it was a big deal. And I remember in the race, you know, I went out of the pits and you sort of go through a Dunlockers. And I remember looking to the right, there's a campsite with a whole load of Indian flags. And it was a miserable year. It rained all week. But I just thought to myself, you know, those people have come and stayed in the piss wet mud in a tent to watch me race. And it's pretty cool. So
yeah.
Motor racing, I think in general, for every 10 days, you have 9 pretty crappy ones. But those one good ones that you have, they make up for the other 9, you know, the joy you get from that one makes up for the other 9 crappy ones. And yeah, so I think on balance, I don't have much to complain about, really.
Back to road cars. What was your first ever road car?
Oh, you'll like this. So, you know, I said my dad ran a rally team. Well,
yeah.
At the end of the season, there was one of the rally cars. He took out the roll cage, so still had all the holes in it. And put the seats back and put a bit of lining into it. And for some reason, they had some gold paint. So they painted it gold. I had gold. One of the mechanics decided he put the, you know, those gold wire sort of BBS wheels that you used to get?
Yeah. I used to have them on a Mark II Golf GTI.
Well, there you go. I had a gold Suzuki Swift with gold BBS wheels. It was
nice.
Horrendous.
Mate, I bet you thought you were mint.
I thought it was the best thing ever because I managed to blag a one of their sort of Group A close ratio gearboxes in it. And I just thought that was the best thing ever. But yeah, that was the first thing I had. And then when I came to England... I didn't have anything. So on the way back from Pembrey, my first day of testing was at Pembrey in February. And as we were driving back, one of the guys in the team arranged for me to meet a secondhand car dealer at a services on the M4. And we bought this Vauxhall Vectra. I still remember the registration. It was R363BBH. It was an R-Reg 97 Vectra, 2-litre Vectra. And so we go home anyway. It was dark, right? By that point, it's February, coming back from in the evening. Next morning, we wake up. My dad and I look out the window. He looks at it. He says, "Every panel on that car has got a different color." And honestly, it was a range of, you know, pinks, reds, and oranges. It was.
And do you remember how much you paid for it?
£3,400.
Oh my God! Big money.
That's a lot.
I know, it was big cash. And it was horrendous. So then, so anyway, we once we looked at it, it's like, oh God. Look, you know, but we'd also, that was the first day we'd heard of a shop called IKEA because I'd never even heard of it.
Yeah.
And the mechanics, I was like, we got this house, got no furniture in it. They said, oh yeah, you should go to this place called IKEA. So we go down there and we load up, you know, my dad's driving. I'm in the back seat. The wardrobe's over my head, over the back seat. And I went, okay, I'm in. You know, I'm sort of crouched underneath. And he slammed the boot. As he slammed the boot, the wardrobe went through the front windscreen.
No.
Yes.
God.
Oh, God. So,
see, they're great, great memories, aren't they? They're
great days.
Brilliant.
Oh, no, yeah. Great days. I mean, we, you know, we bought this idiotic because we had no idea that we had to assemble it all ourselves and how painful it would be. We bought a futon with about 50 slats of wood. And we spent 3 days assembling this stupid thing.
A futon. Do you remember those days? The futon. Yeah.
Futons. Futons were big in the 90s and the early 2000s. They were. Lots of people had a futon.
So this was 2002. But yeah. Mad times.
Yeah, they were big then. Answer me this, Karan. A lot of people don't realize that Leyland is still a big name in India. Is that correct? Am I right in thinking that actually a lot of the British Leyland, the jigs and the old factory stuff actually went out to India and they carried on making a lot of the Leyland cars way beyond where they'd stopped in this country?
I don't know about the cars. Certainly the trucks they did, and they still do. So it's a brand called Ashok Leyland, which is still the biggest truck manufacturer, I think, in India. So, yeah, you know, certainly there's quite an influence, right? When my, you know, when my granddad started racing in the 60s, obviously the you know, the British left India in 1947, but there was still a load of Brits dotted around. And when they started leaving, they started selling their cars off to the locals before they flew back. You know, so I remember my granddad bought a Fraser Nash from somebody. They bought, you know, there was an old Jag that he bought from someone. And these were people who were just wanting to get rid of their cars cheap before they could fly back.
Was it the Morris Oxford that was the taxi of the time?
Yeah, it was called the Ambassador.
Okay, but it was essentially a Morris Oxford, wasn't it?
Exactly that. And I think they only stopped producing it in probably about 10 years ago. But, you know, it had the bench seats for the front and the back. And you could get... You could get, you know, four in the front. You get eight people in this car. But yeah, no, it had the, you know, the gear lever on the sort of stick, like an indicator stick, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, hilarious things.
I'm sure I've driven a Morris Oxford or maybe even a Westminster at Goodwood at the Revival. You must have driven some old knackers like that, have you?
Well, I mean, I've driven the Ambassadors a lot. We used to do this thing with because the handbrake, so the gear lever was up on the stick, but the handbrake was down on the floor. So we used to do this trick where, you know, one of us would sit in the footwell or the passenger side and the other one would be driving it. And you couldn't see and they go, pull! And you know, the one on the floor would pull the handbrake and we do this sort of handbrake turns with these things. It's hilarious. But yeah, listen, you know, you and I both enjoy going to Goodwood. I mean, we drive all sorts of fun old things and all sorts of minis to Can-Am cars to Cobras.
Hey, come on. I'll be super honest now for you, Dave. Honest to God, when I do the TT, and I mainly do it in a good pal of mine in his big block Corvette Stingray, honestly, it properly scares me.
Does it?
Yeah, oh, yeah. How about you, Karan?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jason and I had a really good race in a mini in 2013, wasn't it? We had a really good race. You were in James Martin's car, and I was sharing with Nick Swift. Yeah, and that was great fun. And you're not afraid of it because, you know, they're minis and they're fun. But you're absolutely right. Once you get into bigger things, you know, I think we've all gotten used to slightly sanitized circuits and cars with modern tires and grip and and a bit of downforce and things like that. And suddenly those things. And the trouble is you arrive at the racetrack with all the right intentions of, we're going to be careful and we're not going to push it. We'll take it easy. Then you put the helmet on and the redness comes down and we all behave like idiots. So,
Is there a difference between, for example, if you're racing and you're in a factory car, a team car, whatever it is, and obviously if collisions happen and it's all part of racing. If you're racing in somebody else's pride and joy, you're in James Martin's Mini, you're in Swifty's Mini, whatever it might be, do you pull back slightly because you don't want to bend it and you don't want to come in with a couple of wing mirrors missing?
100%. Yeah, no, 100%. Listen, the first objective for any of us doing these things is to get the car back in one piece, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think we're all very respectful of the fact that it's fun weekend. So you do keep it within your limits, but, you know, you have to remember these cars are 1960s cars. Okay, some, you know, a lot of them have been modified with bits and pieces, but deep down they're 1960s cars, and yeah. Goodwood is a 1960s racetrack. You know, it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
So,
and it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
You know, if you go off, you are going to hit something. So you do have to be incredibly respectful of the circuit as well.
I mean, the Can-Am car I drove in 2019 when I won the Whitson Trophy, we were doing 176 mile an hour in that thing.
Why were you doing that? That's ridiculous, man.
Well, now looking back at it, yes, it was. But, you know, you do, don't you? And you just... You're trying to be quick in anything you drive, and that's just so ingrained in us. When we go off and do the fifth gear filming days, it's the same thing. It's just ingrained in us that we're trying to drive as quickly as possible. You know, part of it is because you know the person in the passenger seat is absolutely hating it, and it's very funny.
That's so true, isn't it?
But I think a big part of it is it's just ingrained in us.
You mentioned fifth gear there. Fifth gear recharged, which is currently on our screens as we speak. As somebody who is without doubt a dyed-in-the-wool petrol head, has it been an adjustment to get your head around, obviously, new technology, new types of car going forward, as in electric vehicles?
I think less for me than it has for the other presenters, to be honest, because really? I raced in Formula E. Because I did a season of Formula E, and you know, I had that reset back then. And so, yeah, I think where it's still difficult is, you know, thinking in terms of kilowatts and, you know, thinking in terms of just it's a different metric, isn't it, by the way we judge what makes a good car and what isn't a good car. You know, there's only so many times you can jump in these things and say, woohoo, they all accelerate quickly, because they all do, because they're electric. Yeah. And then you have to kind of have a reset of, okay, what is the differentiator? What makes one electric car better than the other?
It's quite tricky, isn't it, to find the character of these cars, because they are, you know, they don't have it. They don't have what an engine gives you in terms of feel and sound and all these sorts of other senses you get. They're gone, and it does make them kind of the same, so it's quite tricky.
Are they functional? Is that the word for a lot of these cars? You know, they do what they do well, but as you're implying, Jason, they don't have that character. They don't necessarily give you that emotion.
Well, I think the very, very new ones now, the manufacturers have learned how to put character into them. So, you know, if you go back like 2-3 years, they were all a bit dull, to be honest. And I think, you know, I spent 2 days in the Kia EV6 in Germany. And you know what? I loved it. And
oh,
it was great.
I saw that one. Yes.
It was really great. And I, to answer your question earlier, I was very skeptical of the EV thing. Didn't like it. Bit of an old dinosaur. Want a V8, yada, yada, yada. So I've been on this journey, this kind of discovery. And you know what? I'm nearly there, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard you talk about this before. You'd have one, wouldn't you? Not necessarily as your only car, but you'd certainly have one as one of your two cars, perhaps.
Absolutely. I think the next car we have, you know, the family car for Soph, you know, for school runs and nipping around town and all the rest of it. Honestly, I think we're going to go electric.
I think we're the same. I think it won't be our only sort of option at home. I think we'll still have one ICE car, but yeah, certainly as a second car. Nope. My wife's car is done. I jumped in it this morning, just moving around the drive, and it's done 7,000 miles in, you know, 2.5 years. And she doesn't do the mileage, so it really, an electric car will be absolutely fine as a second car.
And if you look at the numbers, what it costs, this is on the assumption that you plug it in at home, you charge it at home. I mean, it's peanuts to run the things.
Yeah, well, this is a thing, because I think the perception is always that electric cars are expensive and arguably too expensive. And I think that's the big barrier to entry for a lot of people. But as you say, and this is why the current series of Fifth Gear Recharge have been so good, is that when you look at those things and you sort of say, right, well, the electric equivalent of this particular car is £2,500 more than its petrol equivalent. However, when you do the running cost maths, it all comes down. And surely that is a... an investment worth having in the long term over certainly 3 or 5 years.
But that conversation we've just had and what you've just said completely underlines the fact that electric cars are functional and don't have emotional appeal or soul in the ways that the ICE cars. And I think that is a real consideration for motor racing. You know, I think back to going to the, you know, standing on the grass banks of watching, you know, I came from India in 1996 to watch the touring car race at Silverstone. I stood at Cops Corner and watch all these guys driving around. And even the sound of a touring car, let alone the screaming V10s of an F1 car, made it exciting to someone, you know, who's 10, 12 years old watching that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think in F1, when we used to be able to hear the cars 7, 8 miles away. I used to live in Brackley and I could hear testing happening at Silverstone. You know, that's 8 miles away.
Yeah.
And that creates some emotional feeling in your stomach, doesn't it? That you think, holy smoke, what is that? I want to go see it.
There's that great line, isn't it? And the line is, we sell noise.
Yeah. And I think to me, that's such a important ingredient of the passion involved in motor racing for the fans is the sound of the cars.
Do you remember the pushback when Formula One went really quiet in the first year of the turbo, you know, the turbo cars? It was awful, awful, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they're not actually that much different now, but people have got used to it. And this is why I think, you know, F1 needs to have a little bit of a think and the FIA needs to have a little bit of a think about the future direction of Formula One. My personal opinion, and it's probably not a popular one with manufacturers, is that we should get rid of the hybrids. We shouldn't be hybrid anymore. I think F1, the reality is with the way the rules work, right? You know, you set a set of regulations and they're in place then for 4 or 5 years. The trouble is, in that 4 or 5 years, the road car industry is now plowing so much money into R&D and research. F1 is no longer really the leader in terms of research into the hybrids or the battery technology, point A. Point B, the energy recovery system that works on the MGUH, which is the turbo system, you'll never, ever put that on a road car because it only works if you're driving flat out at full throttle, or it works most efficiently at full throttle, I should say.
Yeah.
So, which you don't do on the road. So you'll never have that crossover from F1 to the road car industry anyway. Mm. So to me, we should now with Le Mans and LMDH and all that, you know, hybrid development happening with new manufacturers coming into Le Mans and sports cars, they should do hybrids and battery development in sports car racing. And F1 should do synthetic and biofuels and look for what happens next. Because I think you can get rid of the battery and all the other hybrid stuff. You'll save 120 kilos of weight. It'll be better for the tires. It'll create better racing. The cars will be lighter and more agile. I think you'll have the opportunity to go back to a V8 or a V10, screaming loud engines trying to run on biofuels, which will sound amazing and look amazing. So to me, you know, it probably won't happen because the manufacturers don't want it to happen, but that's what I would like to see for 2026.
What they don't want biofuels to come in as a legitimate alternative to battery technology.
No, they don't want to get rid of the hybrids. They want to keep it as hybrid because they see that as being the crossover. But I'm not convinced.
But it's true that they're putting a lot of effort into e-fuel, aren't they? Into synthetic.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they're scared to commit. And the feeling I get is that F1 and the manufacturers around F1 are scared to fully say goodbye to hybrid technology because they still see that as an important part of the future.
But here's a question for you. So in terms of manufacturers, we heard recently that Audi had stated that they were going to make no more combustion engines from whatever date and obviously focus their attentions on electric vehicles. If synthetic fuels are to be a viable way forward, then is that not a bit of a change in direction in itself? Because surely biofuels are going to be reliant upon the normal combustion engine technology. So, you know, to actually make that statement now in 2021, it's almost a bit like, well, we're either going to take this path or this path. And surely you can't take both.
Well, they can they? Because if you look at across the group, they've got multiple brands. So they could easily say, we're going to send Audi down this path or then Porsche down that path and you know, Volkswagen on that path and Skoda and Seat. And
well, that's what's happening, is it? Porsche are putting a lot of investment into e-fuel.
Yeah, and To be honest, what I don't like, and you know, I heard a really good podcast from Andy Palmer, the former boss of Aston Martin and Nissan, mm-hmm. and he made a really good point, which is the future direction of what all of us are driving shouldn't be dictated by the government. Yeah. It should be dictated by technology. And what he means is, if the governments are all saying by 2030, 35, 40, whatever, right? All the different governments around the world are coming up with a number. We should be all driving electric cars. That's mm-hmm. wrong. What they should be saying is by these dates, the emission numbers should be this low. Now, all of you go off and create whatever ways yes. to achieve those numbers. Because otherwise, what you're effectively doing is forcing all of the engineering minds into going into this electric pathway to achieve the targets set by the governments instead of allowing creativity to come up with other better ways. And I thought that's a really interesting point that Andy made.
Yeah, I mean, there is one big hurdle to all this electric thing. And Paddy Lowe's come up with this concept, and that is the energy density of batteries is so not even on the same, it's not even in the same book, let alone the same page or chapter as hydrocarbons. So effectively, things like aircraft will never, ever, ever be electric unless there's a monumental change in technology. And that's so many years away. I mean, that could be 50 years away. It's certainly not around the corner. So there's still going to be a need for hydrocarbon-style fuel with massive energy density. And that means we've got to go e-fuel. And boats, I mean, boats won't ever be battery. So I'm with you, Karun. They've got to stop driving the manufacturers in one direction. They've got to allow them to come up with new tech.
And I think in some ways, right, I think governments have, you know, they've picked cars and mobility as a showcase of, you know, let's make an example out of how we're going to go green with the cars and that world. Don't get me wrong, we all absolutely need to be doing things to make the world a greener place. But what about gas central heating? You know, you just need to look at the stats coming out of the emissions from that.
Yeah.
You mentioned boats. You know, the emissions coming out of the container boats and the stuff they dump in the oceans, it's unbelievable. If you look at the emissions, and they're all getting greener, you know, aircraft engines are getting greener all the time. But the emissions from one Atlantic crossing on one of those, you know, massive aircrafts is colossal compared to what a Renault Clio is going to pop out of here.
Yeah, very true.
And I think, you know, in some ways, I do think the road car industry is, and the automotive industry, should I say, has been an easier thing for people to pick on.
Easy target, isn't it?
Yeah.
Before we let you go and unpack your bag from Abu Dhabi, because I'm conscious that you've not long got home. He's going to have sand in his knickers. He's going to have to like rinse off his flip-flops and all that kind of stuff. Before we do that, Karun, a couple of questions that we like to ask all of our guests here on Fueling Around. And here's one for you. Of all of the cars you've ever owned, you need to pick one and one only and stick with it for the rest of your life. Which one is it and why?
It's going to be a very boring answer, but I had a Audi A6 Estate with a 3-liter twin turbo engine.
Yeah.
And that was just the best. It was so, it's practical, but it's an estate. I could put my bikes, all the kids' stuff. And it's just a great car. You could cruise along at 74 miles an hour if you wanted to.
You lying get.
Yeah.
77, I know it is.
Yeah. You're braver than me. But that was it. It's just a great car, great road car.
Good choice. Wow. Good choice.
It is a good choice. So another question we like is music and cars go together. If you could choose any car, and it can be whatever you like, where are you going to go to? Where are you going to drive and what are you going to listen to?
So any car would have to be an F40. That's the poster I had on my wall as a kid growing up. I would probably do, what drive would I do? Something like Stelvio Pass, something like that, because, you know, you want to do it in Italy.
Yeah.
And I would, It's funny, you know, I've gone off having music in the car for the last 3 years. I'm a podcast and audiobook person now.
Is the right answer.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
He's good, isn't he? Isn't he good?
He's very good. He's very good.
Yeah. I mean, that's only because of you two. It's genuinely a thing. I've sort of, yeah.
Do you know what? I'm a bit the same, actually. I used to want big speakers in my car and all that sort of stuff. But last 3 years, I like listening to people. And
you know what put me onto audiobooks was actually doing Fifth Gear, because we'd have these shoots up in places like Anglesey or in Llandaff in Wales. And I go, hang on a second, I can listen to nonsense on the radio or listen to LBC like Jason does and come here with all his political opinions.
or anger.
Or I could actually basically read a book. And I think a lot of it comes, we just don't have time to sit down and read a book anymore in life.
Yeah.
And when we were doing the 50 issues, I started doing audiobooks, and I just saw it's just a great way for me to get my reading done.
It's just a far better use of time, isn't it? As you say, you know, because they're dead hours, especially if you're driving to Anglesey and back. I mean, what's that, 5 hours each way, probably, depending on where you live? Yeah.
I'm waiting for you to get your heli sorted, Jace, you know.
Oh, those days are long gone, mate. They're long gone.
Anyway,
and on that note,
Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, do you know what, Corinne? Mate, I love that, but that's about it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor across your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thanks to you, but a huge thanks to our special guest this week, Mr. Karun Chandhok. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to get your thoughts on the weekend's action, amongst other things. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you'd like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening. And, well, we'll see you next time. Ta-da!